Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I have an exciting show for you with a very special guest, very familiar on this program, which is former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz. Now, Catherine's also the president of Solari.com, where she does the Solari Report. These are some of the most in-depth, informative reports that you'll find anywhere. Catherine, it's great to have you back with us.
It's great to be back, Daniel.
Now, I know you have a new report coming out on the space economy, and it's absolutely fascinating, and we're going to get into that in depth in late June. But today I wanted to do something special, which is take a deep look at your previous report, Control 101, which is absolutely amazing and just full of incredible details. So I want to start off with a quote from it here. So there's a brand new healthcare clinic and a brand new prison and a brand new criminal justice center in every county. The middle class is liquidated through the hospitals, and the lower class is liquidated through the criminal justice system. And both are drug systems. So the middle class is on pharmaceuticals, and the low income go to narcotics and through criminal justice. But it's the same process, and they're making money on both of them. The lines between the two are nicely calibrated to optimize their profits, both on the pharmaceutical and on the covert cash flows. Now there's a lot in there. The controlled crime part, the liquidation of the middle class, and the boom in these sorts of institutions. Now, I find that circle absolutely fascinating.
Well, it was very frightening. This is one of the insights that comes from doing as much driving as I do around the country. But I was watching a variety of different things happen. First was the explosion in the stock market. The stock market was really lifted up by Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And the stock market was being driven by these fantastic profits and anticipated profits in everything from healthcare equipment to pharmaceuticals. And what you were watching as you drove around, I always watched the grocery stores. The grocery stores were shifting and allocating much more of their space to pharmaceuticals. So they were anticipating, you know, an explosion in pharmaceuticals. And, you know, and you could a lot of it. I was viewing through the watching the stock market, sort of what was moving and what wasn't, and what the impact on Obamacare was on these different company P&Ls. But then what you realized was, oh well, you know, we've been on this process for about 10 years, but it's accelerating of big construction coming from new hospital facilities or doctor offices ancillary to the hospitals, as well as the new criminal justice centers. And as you drove around, it was happening in every county. It was, you know, it was like somebody was stamping out a model.
Wow.
and what you really, yeah. And frankly, in the 90s, a lot of the growth at that time we were seeing in communities was in fact from healthcare. But in the meantime, I used to work out with a retired drug dealer from my county.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always grill him about how the money works on his business.
Okay.
And what I discovered was, you know, a lot of it was pain management, and people were buying illegal drugs to deal with pain management because they couldn't afford the pharmaceuticals. They didn't have health care insurance. And so
right.
You were really seeing, and for some reason, the opioid, you know, I've never investigated the opioid epidemic, but my guess is it was right at the intersection of those two. And so, you know, and no one ever asked the question, why are so many people in pain all the, you know, in physical pain all the time? But it was clear we had a model, and that model was liquidating both populations in different ways.
Huh, that's so interesting. Just this idea that it's that well integrated into the system is disturbing enough. And apparently it's working on multiple levels all the time. And it's also quite an eye-opener too, because very often there's a tendency to think that the middle class is inoculated somehow.
I grew up in a world where I was part of a group of people who, they were planners. You know, we had 100-year plans, 50-year plans, 20-year plans. I mean, there was a lot of planning going on. And so it's my nature, you know, fundamentally I'm trained as a portfolio strategy to see the plan roll out before it's announced.
Right.
You know, because we've become a society where everything is an op as opposed to, you know, a government program or a new corporate product. But anyway, I remember in the early 90s watching the new design and build outs of airports happening. You know, it was from about mid-90s on, where they were basically turning airports into shopping malls, anticipating that people would go to the airport to shop. I thought, how are they ever going to get this to work? What's the plan? And then, of course, 9/11 happened, and suddenly everybody has to spend 2 hours at the airport.
Oh, yes.
But if you look at how they were building out the new airports, they knew well in advance. You know, they knew 5 years ahead that people would be spending 2 hours at the airport.
Oh, right.
Right. So, you know, that...
That's inside knowledge.
Yeah, that was a plan. So it's my nature to kind of look at these trends and understand, and you don't really see it. You know, I spent a lot of time trying to encourage people to do place-based data. You don't see what's happening until you map out the financial ecosystems by place. And if, you know, if you look at, I've spent a lot of time figuring out, okay, if we were going to make a local economy really healthy and vibrant and grow the economy in a way that's really healthy for the environment, healthy for the living, both the people and animals in that place, how would we do it? And of course, what you're watching is you're seeing it going in a completely different direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are many neighborhoods that could use a whole lot of organic farms and raw dairies.
Yes.
They don't.
Definitely.
You know, they don't need a criminal justice system. In fact, one of the reasons we have so many problems with crime is people aren't healthy.
Oh, there's no question.
One reason for financial problems in this country is poor health.
Oh, I completely agree. And in your work, you've done a great job of illustrating the impact of the black budget in destroying these neighborhoods across America, including their health, and the devastating impact of the criminal environment that it creates with the drug profits in these places.
Right. It's you know, the black budget finances one neighborhood at a time. It finances one person, one family. We did this great series of cartoons, and one cartoon was an invisible hand was reaching through a wall and pulling out, pickpocketing a guy's wallet. And the guy's turning to a friend, he's a businessman, he's got an attaché case, and he says, black budget, you know, why should I care about that? What does it mean to me? I want nothing to do with it. Meantime, the hand is pulling his wallet out, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I always talk about it with narcotics trafficking, because one of my first deep dives was narcotics trafficking and mortgage fraud, which are, you know, for many years were critical to the black budget. And I used to say, some soccer moms can't back, you know, Tony Soprano runs the narcotics trafficking and mortgage fraud in your community. And if a group of soccer moms get together and try and back Tony Soprano out, what they discover is Tony Soprano is financing James Bond, and the next thing you know, James Bond and the black helicopters are coming down on their heads. So, and that's the problem with it. It's such a centralized model. No neighborhood is allowed to escape the model. And so the question is, you know, how do you deal with the soccer moms when they give Tony Soprano trouble?
Yeah, right.
Right.
So this is the central banking warfare model.
Right.
And this is right. The main thing that people need to get in order to get a handle on what's really happening. Now, before you published Control 101, you were originally going to do a report about going local.
Right.
And everything that entailed, local currencies, local farms. But you realized that you had to deal with the control issues first, as it's the main stumbling block.
It's really amazing. For 20 years, I find that I am up against a wall. It's almost like I'm committed to spending the rest of my life with people telling me I'm wrong. But for literally for 10 to 20 years, I kept dealing with financial professionals who were saying the market's going to collapse, the economy is going to implode, and I would say, no, it's not. It's going to slow burn. And the primary difference between them and me was my understanding of control technologies. And of course, because I understood control technologies, I understood that there had been a financial coup and the money hadn't been lost. It hadn't gone to, you know, it was still here and it was being reinvested. You know, and so it was a very different analysis, but it all came down to an appreciation and understanding of control technologies. And whenever I tried to talk to the financial professionals about the difference between slow burn and their vision of implosion, they would refuse to talk to me about the control technologies. It's just like, we're not going there. That's too unpleasant, or that's dangerous to talk about, or, you know. And what was amazing to me, Daniel, was year after year after year, you know, because I'm a big believer in lessons learned. When I make a mistake, when I'm wrong about something, I sit down and say, okay, why was I wrong? What can I learn from that? How can I be better next time? Mm-hmm. And it's for any real professional, lessons learned and integrating lessons learned is essential. But, you know, for the last 20 years, it's going to implode. It didn't implode, but it's going to implode next year. You know, it's going to implode next month, tomorrow. Can we talk about what? No, it's going to, you know. So there's this state of denial. Anyway, so then what happened was every time I've tried to talk with people about go local.
Yes.
We can't get anything done or we hit the same wall. Because if you're going to go local, you need to be prepared with the fact that Tony Soprano is financed by James Bond. And how are you going to deal with the NSA listening to your, you know, the soccer moms? And how are you going to deal with the Black Hillock? You know, you've got to have practical plans about how you're going to get something accomplished.
Right.
And sure enough, it was the same problem. We don't want to talk about that. We can't. And I thought, well, if we can't talk about reality, how are we going to deal with the reality? And then finally, I started running into, I've been doing due diligence on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and was really inspired by a series of events to do a serious, the kind of due diligence that an investment advisor or an investment banker is required by professional standards to do. It's a big job. And I have a wonderful friend who used to be head of research at National Semiconductor, who's absolutely, you know, he's got a PhD from MIT. He's one of my resident geniuses. So I called him and I said, you know, I keep trying to do due diligence, but I need a big brain. So will you help me? So we started to do Skype dates every night to unpack. And I did some very, I also traveled around to talk to the top cryptologists I know. So I really did a very serious 100 kind of hour. And then I sat down and I said, you know, this really is as bad as I thought.
Now, a few months ago, you and I did a whole episode called The Bitcoin Op that really outlined the major problems there. But if you can show us an outline here what the main issue is that you have with cryptocurrencies.
So Mr. Global is getting all the freedom fighters to invent his digital currency mechanisms and transactions. You know, it's many things. It's complex. Mm-hmm. So, and I thought, but I ran into so many wonderful people who were adamant that this somehow, that the cryptocurrency revolution was going to solve all of our problems.
Right.
And they didn't understand that when you have a governance structure that is invisible, does not have integrity, and is controlling you through physical force, there is no such thing as a financial solution to that. Because if I control the physical world, I control the hardware, I control the train tracks, I control the cables that go underneath the ocean, I control the satellites in the sky, I'm in control.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's funny, people kept coming to me and saying, we want you to start a digital currency. We want you to start a currency. We would trust a Solaria currency. I said, unless I have an army and you know, breakthrough energy weapons, I can't ensure integrity on a currency. It was very funny. One of the developers tried to get me to take delivery of my name's Solaria and Solaria Investment Advisory on Ethereum. And I took a look at the contract and I said, I'm not accepting delivery of this. What you're saying is I can build a platform on these things and Goldman Sachs can basically take it away from me whenever they want. It's a leasing deal where I have absolutely no rights.
Uh-huh. Wow.
You know, I have that deal in Washington. It cost me $6 million. I don't need that deal again.
You don't know, yeah. But you make a fantastic point about it, which is, well, your classic quote is, you can't solve a political problem with a financial product.
Yeah, you can. It's not, you know, or a digital product. I mean, the whole point of Writing Control 101 was to kind of reach into the minds of so many wonderful people and help them come back to coherence about how control works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, control in our world runs by force, physical force. That's why we spend over $1 trillion a year on military hardware and budgets.
Right.
It's run by force. And the West's dominance, if you study history, and that's the Samuel Huntington quote is in there, our success in this world comes, our success at building weapons and maintaining physical force. That is the history. I mean, how did we get the wonderful real estate that we sit on in the United States? We came here, we killed all the people who were here, and now it's our land, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
How did we get it? With physical force.
Right. That's the history. But there's this idea out there, since you went into Bitcoin, that Bitcoin is somehow this road to freedom because the cryptocurrencies will have people operating decentralized and all the rest of it. We did an episode where you showed that up and you wrote Bitcoin the Op, and it's made all these waves there to get people to look deeper. And people, I think, are starting to catch on.
Right. I think so, too. Well, the book, I really encourage everybody, and I mentioned it in the Control 101 wrap-up. The book I tried to get everybody to read is Tim Wu's book, The Master Switch. Mm-hmm. He goes back through history and describes waves of new information technology, and after each one is introduced, there's this wonderful period of innovation when things get figured out, and then whammo! It's suddenly controlled by one or two players, and everything centralizes some more.
Yeah.
And we've gone through these, you know, and as you read the book, you realize, oh, here, you know, we keep doing this. And every time you go through this wonderful period of innovation, everybody's thinking, oh, this is going to make everything much more wonderful. We're going to have much more freedom. This is great. And then wham, more centralization. Mm-hmm. And I think we're in that period of wonderful innovation. So one of the greatest fundamental market demands on the planet, Daniel, is the desire for local currencies. There is tremendous hunger. Because if you come into any county, I'll use America, but this translates worldwide. Come into any county, and the desire and the need to optimize the economies are hugely sub-optimized, hugely. And so if local communities could create their own currencies without any kind of political interference, you know, and if they could use gold and silver as currencies and avoid the, you know, there's a lot of sales tax and other compliance. But if they were free to make and use local currencies and time bank without political interference and NSA interference, it's remarkable what can happen, but they're not allowed to. But we are allowed to circulate currencies, which is a remarkable, you know, if we're free to create our own currencies, what's the problem with local currencies?
So that really tells us what's going on. You know, I walked to my local coffee shop and there was a big billboard standing outside, and it said Bitcoin ATM. And I thought to myself, this is something obviously that's being done under the agreement of the powers that be.
Right.
Your local currency question goes right to the heart of it, though. The minute someone goes to do a local currency, the way that you put it, the black helicopters show up. And
once the currency thing gets further worked out, they're going to show up and say, oh, well, let's do local cryptocurrencies. Because, in fact, all of those are plugged right into the NSA, right?
Yes.
Right. But if we should do something physical that's not plugged into the NSA, oh, you know, watch that not work. You know, it's funny. I was getting lobbied unbelievably. In my experience, when someone's point of view will not, you know, they can't get their way through logic, they turn into bullies.
Uh-huh.
And so before I left for Europe, I was getting bullied really intensely. And it reminded me, Jack Kemp, when he was Secretary of Ed, used to do these bully hits on me that were just unbelievable.
Right.
And I was having this, it was like, you know, why do I feel like the spirit of Jack Kemp is hovering in this conversation? Started to happen, and it was so textbook. I said, okay, there's something really wrong here. I've got to look into it. But the whole point was that this was going to make us free of the central banks. So I go to Europe. I'm in Germany for the Bregenz Festival. I take the train down to Basel, Switzerland, to interview Thomas Meyer. Great interview. Thomas drives me to the Basel train station because I'm going over to Zurich for meetings. I arrive with my credit card to buy my ticket to Zurich on the Swiss Federal Railway System, having just driven past the Bank of International Settlements. Now, the Bank of International Settlements is architecturally one of the most distinct buildings in the world. Okay, so it's right there. I'm right going past it. I walk up to the machine, and it offers to sell me my ticket to Zurich with Bitcoin, and I can top up my wallet if I want to buy more Bitcoin.
Aha.
So, you know, I've been bullied for, you know, a month before leaving on the theory that this will make a spree and this is a decentralized grassroots movement. But I'm literally a half a mile from the Bank of International Settlements and I'm being offered by the Swiss railway system to sell me Bitcoin.
Wow.
So I said, you know, I think there is a misunderstanding here of what this is all about.
Yeah.
Now, the hardest thing, one of the hardest things in the financial system for the central bankers is now that you have smartphones moving around the globe, and we're going to get to a world where essentially almost everybody has a smartphone, how do you get the transaction costs for financial transactions down low enough so that the people in the emerging markets and the frontier markets can really afford to play?
Uh-huh.
And how do you do currencies in a mobile-friendly environment that will really work? And so this gets back to building the train tracks. It's very difficult and complex. I mean, it's not that we don't have fabulous digital systems and transaction systems in the West. The reality, though, is if you look at the fees, that's not going to hunt the emerging markets and the frontier markets. So they've got to get systems worked out to a much higher degree of speed and compatibility and everything else. And I have to tell you, if I was the Bank of International Settlements and the central bankers, I would say, you know, let's do it exactly what they're doing, because we need all the smartest software developers in the world to prototype and invent this. We need a period of prototyping and invention to really see how this thing could go. And the beauty of it is, you know, there, among other things, in addition to inventing the train tracks for global digital currencies, they're basically inventing a way for the bankers to get out of deposit insurance, which is the banker's wet dream.
Excellent point. Yes. No FDIC.
Right. Right. So, you know, it's, but if the central bankers sat down and said, okay, we're going to get all the government contractors to hire, you know, 100,000 really smart young software developers and figure this out, you know, they couldn't, it would cost more money than it would to just run a Bitcoin up.
Right.
Right. And if you look at how this is working, you know, you have enough money so that you can manipulate and manage the stock market, the bond market, and the derivative market. So I think managing the Bitcoin price is not that difficult. But if you look at how much is being hacked, I mean, you can manage it just with what you're hacking because the ownership is so consolidated.
Yeah, well, I have a stat from early 2018 about Bitcoin that 1,000 individuals own over 40% of it.
Right.
So one of the things you've indicated in situations like this is that we're at the mercy of their movements. You know, when they move, we're going to move. So this idea of an independent freedom currency is really not accurate.
Here's the thing. I don't think the digital systems have any integrity. So, you know, even if you thought you could make the blockchain secure, and I think the problem right now is not making it secure, it's making it secure and economic on scale.
Right.
You know, and that's part of what's got to be figured out. But if you look at the integrity of the transactional process before you go into the blockchain, you know, and the security of the keyboard, the security is not there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what's very curious is when you due diligence the custodian relations on Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies vis-a-vis securities, it's amazing because you're dealing with a whole world of people who don't even know, they don't understand custodian risks, custodian security. You know, they just haven't, they haven't lived in that world and experienced all the things that can go wrong. Although I think some of the exchanges are clearly beginning to experience it. So it's very, very young. And not one of the things I've always said is the day the SEC approves an ETF with somebody who's prepared to provide a really professional custodian, experiences when the price, you know, could double again or more.
Can you just tell us what a custodian is?
Sure. So whenever my subscribers ask me, I always recommend they buy and hold on a hard wallet. Cambridge University did a very interesting study of the whole cryptocurrency industry. And one of the things they pointed out, as of January 2017, 70% of the people left their private key on an exchange, which means it's not private. Uh-huh. In other words, that's like me putting money in a bucket and putting it out on my front porch. Okay? Because your private key, your private key is public and hackable. So, you know, same with a wallet on a phone. Not safe. So if you're operating with a wallet on a phone, you should only have in that wallet what you're planning on transacting, you know, today. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm not going to go to the South Bronx with $500,000 sitting in my wallet, right?
Absolutely.
So it's the same idea. Okay, so I always encourage everybody to have a hard wallet so you have your private key, nobody else has your private key, and not only that, you're offline.
Okay.
Because the system... The keystroke and the transactional systems are not secure. So get that thing offline and get it offline with an air gap. That's number one. Number two, make sure you are 100% compliant. I had one of the law firms we work with write a taxation, a special report on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency taxation. Because one of the things I've discovered talking, you know, you've got a lot of young, wonderful people, and they are wildly out of compliance. And they believe mm-hmm. you have to comply, you know, whether it's taxes or the currency transaction reports or any of these other things, because it's all, the system's going to fall apart in a year.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and we're not going to have to. Well, don't laugh. I had a very wealthy colleague call me. It was about 5 or 6 years ago. It was when the fear porn was pumping out. The economy's over.
Oh, yeah.
It was during the bailouts. And they said, you know, I have $80,000 of credit card debt. What should I do? I said, how in the world did you end up with $80,000? It's a very wealthy person. And they said, well, all the fear porn sites said to run up your credit cards and then not pay them because the system was going to implode.
Wow. Incredible.
I said, you should write them a check. You should pay your credit card. And they said, well, why should I pay my credit cards? It's, you know, it's half interest and fees. I shouldn't have to pay it. I said, yeah, you should, because you're stupid. You know.
Oh, no.
I said, you can call them and try and make a deal. You know, try and negotiate if you want, but here's the reality. You're an idiot. So
some tough love.
You're going to have to pay your But, no, it was I had a little Twitter war with some wonderful young guy who said, you know, he didn't have to. I was recommending you ought to go read the taxation report. This is two young, wonderful lawyers who did a fabulous job really detailing it out. And he said, you know, the system with the IRS won't exist in a year. And I said, enjoy your control file.
Unbelievable.
And because I think when this is over, do you know how many people they're going to, because there's a database at NSA, they got everybody and everything. I would bet you they got everybody and everything. So, you know, there's many different ways this could go. But one of it is if you're in noncompliance, you got a control file, you got a problem.
Well, I see what you're saying, which is that Bitcoin isn't exactly a fairy tale, but this kind of magical thinking about it, that now everything will be fair, is just playing into the same hands, actually, that brought us the financial coup of 2008, for example.
Well, it's not a fairy tale in this sense. You can transact. If I can buy or sell, whether the market's managed or not, it's real. Mm-hmm. So people say to me, where do you think the price is going? And, you know, we had Max Kaiser say it was going to 100,000. John McAfee say it was going to 500,000. Depending on how long they need to invent for, it could. The price could go to 500,000 because it's a political choice. It's got nothing to do with economics. And if I'm running this op and I need the train tracks globally to be invented, you know, and do all sorts of things, let's talk about the 2018 election because they are laundering a huge amount of money to the activists using this stuff. So it's funny, Dr. Farrell said, he said, God, this is Hitler's wet dream. You can finance an infinite secret army with money you just create out of thin air.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. Hitler's wet dream. So the question is, how long do they want to run the op and how do they have to take the price? And it's like any speculation, you just need to be able to understand that it's a speculation if you want to put money up and see if the price goes to 500,000, you know, or 100,000 or whatever, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, maybe it collapses tomorrow. You just can't put more money in than you're prepared to lose 100% of.
Right.
You have to make sure you're totally compliant because you don't want to end up with a control file. I don't even want to be in the database. That's my, for reasons which I can explain.
So you're saying, let's understand what this is. You know, you can invest in it. You can try and turn a profit, get some capital gains. That's fine. But don't imagine for a moment that it's some liberty-bringing, freedom-enabling currency that's somehow going to save the world, because that is falling into the trap.
You can play it as a speculative market, okay? You can use it to help you understand how the digital currency systems are going to work in the future, you know, because you want the knowledge. What you cannot do is you cannot let your community, your morphogenic field, your hopes and dreams, your world, your business get caught up in the speculation. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the greatest things we have on the Solera Report is quarterly, we do a Rambus Chartology blockbuster with a technical analyst whose anonymous name is his handle is Rambus. Rambus is the best technical analyst. He does the best technical analysis of anyone I've ever met in my life. The guy's fabulous. Absolute natural gifted genius at this. Anyway, and he's a guy I just absolutely love. I can't say more because I'm not allowed to sort of tell anything about him or who he is or where he is. But Rambus in the internet stock bubble played it perfectly. He ran the tech stocks almost up to the top. He then sold everything. He and his wife took the money, literally got two cases of beer, burnt their house down, built a brand new beautiful home, and bought two cars, all cash, you know, with a ton of money sitting in the bank because he rode, you know, it was an op, and he rode the op. And the whole time he said, this is an op, I'm going to play it. You know, I'm going to play it as a speculative investment, but I'm not going to lose my life to it. I saw other people who literally had themselves, their business, their whole community, their worldview, their psyche destroyed when it crashed. They didn't run it like an op. They let it in. And that's what you can't do. You can't let this, you know, you can't let it bust you financially. You can't let it bust you legally. In other words, understand you're basically riding something that, in my opinion, is a demonic force. Hmm. You want to ride it, it's your business, but, you know, just understand that you need to risk manage the situation.
Now, why is it a demonic force, in your opinion?
Because digital currencies and digital payment systems will be used to control us. Mm-hmm. What I think the bankers want is they want everybody chipped and entrained. You know, it's the Aaron Rousseau vision. I keep showing that wonderful video of Aaron before he died, telling all.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he absolutely nailed it. They want, you know, Daniel, here's your chip, and if you don't behave, we're turning off your money.
Oh, I don't doubt it for a minute.
So I think we're building the train tracks of our own control. And I have one of my watchwords that I've followed ever since I basically got, you know, thrown overboard by the establishment, by your friends at Harvard Corporation down the street from where you live. My one rule is my most precious asset is my time and attention.
Okay.
And I'm only going to invest in things which give life to, you know, the people I serve and give life to me. And if I see something is ultimately developing the train tracks of control, I don't want to contribute.
Catherine, amazing insights, and I couldn't agree more that we have to be very careful not to support the very systems that will be used to control us in the future. Incredible stuff, and let's go into overdrive for subscribers to Dark Journalist with a full hour on how control works, from secret finance to advance technology, entrainment, and more. Go to darkjournalist.com and subscribe now to get that in your inbox this weekend. Of course, Catherine's reports, the new one on the space economy, available at Solari.com, and we'll go in-depth on that coming up in June. Just fantastic material, totally groundbreaking. Catherine, great to see you, and stay right there for part two. Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode with former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz on the black budget, Bitcoin, and mind control. You can find more special reports, deep interviews, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.